You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our first of two podcasts on diagnosing and managing growth hormone deficiency across the lifespan. How does your approach compare with the experts? Hosted by Med Learning Group. This series is designed to meet the educational needs of endocrinologists, pediatric endocrinologists, and other healthcare professionals, including physicians, advanced practice nurses, nutritionists, physician assistants, diabetes educators, and pharmacists, who manage patients with growth hormone deficiency, or GHD. In this episode, we'll be talking about the challenges in achieving a timely and accurate diagnosis of GHD in pediatric and adult patients. We'll also discuss the clinical profiles of long-acting growth hormone therapies and the benefits and drawbacks associated with traditional standard of care therapies for the treatment of patients with GHD. Let's get started. My name is Debbie, and I will be the host of today's podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Craig Alter. Dr. Alter is a professor of clinical pediatrics at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He is also the Thomas Mosheng Jr. Endowed Chair of Pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine, University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, PA. Dr. Alter, thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thank you, Debbie. It's a pleasure to be here and share some of my own experiences.
To start with, can you tell us how growth hormone deficiency presents itself across the lifespan of a patient? Let's start with congenital GHD.
I think that's good that we start with, from the beginning, those with congenital growth hormone deficiency. Some of those kids will present near birth, and some will present later in life only to have a pituitary malformation that must have been through birth. We always look for risk factors for hypopituitarism or growth hormone deficiency. In a male, of course, that's a microphallus and hypoglycemia. In a female, we don't see microphallus, but we will see hypoglycemia, making it a little more difficult to diagnose in a female. Many of our kids present with septo-optic dysplasia. They may present with problems seeing, unilateral vision problems, bilateral vision problems, or just nystagmus that are often referred from one of our ophthalmologists.
Perhaps by describing a case study, can you tell us how you would diagnose a patient with congenital GHD?
Sure. Let me reflect on one case in particular, although I've seen many just like this, of a five-day-old girl who presented with a hypoglycemic seizure. It was clear she had midline defects. She had a large cleft lip and palate. Her vision, it was difficult to assess because she was only 5 days of age. And then a workup, I remember that we weren't sure if she had hyperinsulinism or panhypopituitarism, but it would turn out she actually had just panhypopituitarism. And this is from many years ago when I was an endocrine fellow, and I followed her for the next 25 years or so. Over the years, I could tell you she was treated first, most importantly, to prevent the hypoglycemia. So that would be her steroids, hydrocortisone, and also the growth hormone. But she also received thyroid hormone in addition to growth hormone and later pubertal hormones. And she also required desmopressin. So she had full panhypopituitarism.
Switching gears here, can you walk us through a diagnosis of acquired GHD?
Sure. So the thing about acquired growth hormone deficiency, as we all know, the definitions are not always distinguishing normal versus abnormal. We have some that have clear-cut growth hormone deficiency presenting with severe growth failure and an abnormal pituitary MRI. That's one scenario. But the more common scenario that we see in clinical practice are those that are either very short or those that are somewhat short but growing poorly. And then we order growth hormone testing. The problem with growth hormone testing is that if you're going to order growth hormone testing on almost everyone you see, you're going to overdiagnose growth hormone deficiency. So I caution people to really use growth hormone testing in the proper clinical scenario. IGF-1 is very useful as a screening test. The problem with IGF-1 is that in the newborn period through maybe age 5 or 6, a lot of normal people have very low IGF-1. So it's not that specific. And later on, if you have someone that you're measuring IGF-1 and they have either poor nutrition, very low BMI, they may have a low IGF-1 just from that.
What about GHD in adults?
Well, growth hormone deficiency in adults, I kind of think of that in several categories. Those that have congenital problems, those that have acquired and pediatric problems, and those that have new processes in adults. So the patient I described earlier who had all those midline defects and needed treatment for her pituitary problem since birth, there's no question she was going to have adult growth hormone deficiency. When we get someone with just classic growth hormone deficiency isolated without an abnormal pituitary MRI, they almost never have adult growth hormone deficiency. But for those who have, let's say, a craniopharyngioma or have some severe pituitary gland malformation as evident on MRI, they're also at risk for adult growth hormone deficiency. And the final group are those who are adults that have some sort of process. It might be TBI, traumatic brain injury, or TBI, total body irradiation from some cancer. I like that we have two TBIs, that they both could lead to growth hormone deficiency in adults.
Before we move on to long-acting growth hormone treatment, can you tell us about the benefits and drawbacks associated with traditional standard of care therapies used for treatment of patients with GHD across the lifespan?
Sure. As we know, daily growth hormone works great. It's not that difficult to give. There are often very nice devices or ways to administer it. But of course, it's 365 injections a year, which is difficult to do. It's not only difficult to do, it's not so much the pain. It takes a lot of time. And when we talk about long-acting growth hormone, I could share my experiences and what families have commented to me about when they've switched to long-acting. But in terms of short-acting, there are a few rare severe side effects that we should discuss. One is slipped capital femoral epiphysis, SCIFE. I've seen that twice in my career. They presented with either knee pain or hip pain, usually unilateral. One of the two patients needed a surgical procedure with pins, although he insisted on going back on growth hormone. The other rare side effect, which again, I've seen maybe two or three times in my career, is pseudotumor cerebri. And this presents with headaches and blurry vision. One of the cases I saw presented to someone with a craniopharyngioma who had undetectable growth hormone levels. So that's someone who we really needed to restart growth hormone. After they had seen the neuro-ophthalmologist for a few months, we eventually restarted the growth hormone at extremely low dose, such as 0.1 milligram in a 10-year-old. And then we worked our way up slowly, and then he tolerated it just fine. Other side effects are it raises blood sugars a little bit. And some people comment that they notice the hands and feet are slightly bigger. It's not severe, but they've noticed that. And in terms of scoliosis, growth hormone doesn't cause scoliosis, but certainly while you're growing quickly, the defects are going to be more apparent. And I recommend that everyone get their back checked when you're following someone for growth hormone deficiency on therapy.
Besides standard growth hormone therapy, long-acting growth hormone therapy is now available to treat pediatric and adult patients. Firstly, can you tell us about the challenges of prescribing long-acting growth hormone and who are the best candidates for long-acting growth hormone?
Yeah, this is actually a critical question because my answer to this has changed over the last 3 years. And first of all, the most obvious patient to put on a long-acting growth hormone are ones who have been non-compliant. And I already described a patient who was completely panhypopit, but wasn't growing on daily growth hormone until we switched to long-acting, and he's done amazingly well. That's an obvious situation. But what I found over the last few years is how much patients really enjoy doing once-a-week growth hormone. They tell me it's not about the pain of daily growth hormone. They don't mind that. It's about the amount of time on their schedule that they have to free up in order to give their nightly growth hormone. Now, in terms of challenges, of course, there's the insurance coverage, and that's changing over time, and that's always going to be something to consider. In terms of side effects, well, the side effects of long-acting growth hormone are felt to be the same as that of daily growth hormone. So I always describe the same side effects, the pseudotumor cerebri, the SCIFE, the mild elevation in blood sugars, and things like that. We talk about monitoring levels of the growth hormone by checking IGF-1. The three companies that make the long-acting growth hormone have nicely put out suggestions for how to do that. I typically try to get IGF-1 levels on day 4 after a dose of the weekly growth hormone. It kind of reminds me of testosterone, where when I get the labs, I then have to ask the family, when did you give the last dose before that? And they often have to look at the calendar and say, well, we give it on Fridays. That was a Thursday. And I say, perfect, and things like that. In terms of other challenges, it's really about the dosing. That's, to me, the biggest challenge. You may take somapacitan, where the dose is 0.16 milligrams per kilogram. And when you calculate it, it comes out to 5.2 milligrams. Well, the pen device is 15 milligrams. I suggest to you that you learn what the highest amount of long-acting growth hormone that can be given through one of the devices, and also the total amount of long-acting growth hormone that's contained in the pen. So you could see that 5.2 milligrams is not so convenient on the third dose. So what do? I typically round, a slight rounding, to a dose that's divisible into the amount that the pen contains. In this case, 5.2 milligrams would become 5 milligrams, and you easily get 3 doses or 3 weeks worth in a pen device. One thing I should add is that the somapacitan is the only one that's approved for adult growth hormone deficiency, while all 3 products are indeed approved for growth hormone deficiency in children, but not for other indications that we typically use growth hormone for in a child.
Briefly, can you share some clinical data on these formulations?
Sure. We now have 3 different growth hormones that are long-acting growth hormone. One is long-peg somatotropin, one is somapacitan, and one is somatrogon, made by 3 excellent companies. The initial data looked at height velocity over 1 year of the long-acting growth hormone. Each of the products showed excellent results. They, for example, the long-peg somatotropin had a height velocity of 11.2 centimeters per year as compared to the controls' height velocity of only 10.3. The other ones also had excellent data. They were clearly passing the test for showing that these products work. That doesn't guarantee safety, doesn't guarantee the patients will like it, but it at least shows us that after 1 year, the height velocity was excellent.
Doctor, what unique concerns can one expect from the use of long-acting growth hormone preparations?
So the long-acting growth hormone preparations are felt to have the same side effects as short-acting growth hormone preparations. The one difference is that we don't have long-term data as far as usage of these products with conditions, especially when the condition is not growth hormone deficiency. So these products in the United States are FDA approved for growth hormone deficiency. The somapacitan is also approved in adults for growth hormone deficiency, but they are not yet approved for other conditions where we classically use daily growth hormone therapy. For example, if someone is a cancer survivor and they have growth hormone deficiency, well proven, and they're on daily growth hormone, we don't yet have the approval and safety data published to prove that we could use this in cancer patients. That doesn't mean there's a problem, but we're more cautious on this group of populations. Still, maybe some people are using that. I'm not yet using it in this group. I'm just looking for data and reassuring myself. And the issue is that the IGF-1 profiles are different for daily than for weekly. The IGF-1 profiles are well published. You could see them. They go up, and typically by day 4 is a good time to assess IGF-1 when you're on a long-acting growth hormone for all 3 of the products, because it represents kind of the average IGF-1 level. Still, we're cautious. These are new products, and we have to see over time how well they are working and how safe they are in different groups of people who typically get daily growth hormone.
Well, we've run out of time for this podcast, but we have interesting topics to discuss in our next one. We'll be talking about providing continuity of care for pediatric patients with GHD transitioning into adulthood and how to individualize the long-term management of GHD in these patients. So be sure to tune in. Thank you very much, Dr. Alter, for taking the time to speak with us today and for all the in-depth information you shared. And thanks to all our listeners for joining us. Hopefully you're able to tune into the other podcasts of the series. There are a total of two, as well as some of the many other types of CME programs we offer. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group, who, in support of improving patient care, is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, ACPE, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. The CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACME Essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Novo Nordisk, who provided an educational grant for this activity. Have a great day.